Welcome to the Gurr in Fangirl podcast, a podcast where we discuss pop culture and fandom. Each episode, we talk with celebrities, fans, and creators about their work in the media that inspires them. Now here's your host, the creator of The Squee Project, filmmaker, fangirl, and feminist, Hansi Oppenheimer.
Hey, it's Hansi, and today I'm talking with writer Chad Lutsky. He has written for famous monsters of Filmland, Cemetery Dance, Rue Morgue, and Scream Magazine. His fictional work can be found in several magazines and anthologies, including his own 18-story anthology, Night as a Catalyst. He has written a collaborative effort with horror author Terry M. West, The Hymn Deep Down, and in the summer of 2016, he released his dark coming-of-age novella of Foster Homes and Flies, which had been praised by author Jack Ketchum, James Newman, John Bowden, and many others. His latest work, The Pale White, is available on Kindle for Amazon right now, and the book is soon to be coming out. And you can find him and his work at www.chadlutsky.com. Anyway, here we go. Hey, Chad. Hansi.
Hey, Hansi. How you doing?
How are you?
Pretty good. Pretty good. Okay, I was just going to say, you finally got a break from all of your hard work on your documentary?
Not really.
No?
No. Because it's, you know, I'm really a one-person business, so all of it is me, you know, so...
Yeah.
I got to start making notes on some of the edits. We got, you know, we've gave out surveys at the screening, so I have some notes, and of course, you know, everyone in the Lansdale family gave me notes, although Karen's was cool. It was just, my daughter's music isn't loud enough.
Oh, okay.
But Joe and Casey and Keith all had some notes, and, you know, and they loved it. But, yeah, you know, everyone has. So my editor and I have to go through and just tweak it a little bit before the screening at the George R. Martin thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then if that plays well on the big screen, then we'll, you know, make that the Blu-ray and get that out. But, yeah, it's so different when you see it on a big screen as opposed to, you know, when you're working on it on a small, you know. So some things that worked fine on the small screen when you see them on the big screen, because there's a lot of handheld. I'm like, ooh, that's a little shaky there. We got to stabilize that a little.
Right.
But overall, it was good, yeah. And then I'm booking a New York event in December. Casey's going to be in town, so I thought I'd do it while she's here. So we'll do a New York screening. It's all just, you know, the website. You know how it is. You know, you got to update the website and do the blog and respond to people.
Yeah.
Get merch out. And it's.
Yeah, when you're doing that by yourself, it's really time-consuming.
It's just all the time, you know. And I have a day job now, but, you know, I'm hoping that in a year I can say, you know, don't need you anymore and just do this, because I'd get a lot done. I'm just not sure I can support myself completely on it yet. Do you do a day job, or you just write at this point?
No, I do. I have a part-time day job. So it was full-time, and then I started, the goal is to make, you know, to just write full-time and not have to worry about. But at this point, it probably wouldn't be a smart move just yet.
Yeah, that's where I'm at too. It's a part-time day job, and it's I'm not quite sure, because just, you know, the cost of making things and promoting things and all that, you know, I still, you know, and traveling to the screen and all that stuff, I still wouldn't be able to cover that with what I'm bringing in. I mean, I'm bringing in something, but it's not quite enough, so.
Sure. Yeah, there's definitely a financial investment with doing that kind of stuff.
But yeah, that's the ultimate plan, to be able to just work on your stuff full time. And I think if you commit to that and you're working towards that, you can get there.
Yeah, I think so too. As long as you put in the hard work, just keep at it.
Yeah, I was reading your blog, and I know you do a lot of editing. Do you like the editing?
No. Not really. It depends on the author. If I have to constantly, you know, go through a manuscript and just point out all of the areas where you know, doing the same thing, like, you know, like a big one would be telling instead of showing. You know, that's one where if I've got an author who hasn't learned that yet, that you need to, you know, show instead of tell, then it can make, you know, it can make for a long job. So, but I mean, I don't do it often, but I just kind of, you know, I do it to make a little bit more compensation but I don't necessarily like it.
I saw you do like editing and stuff for Cemetery Dance and some other mags. Like, do you do that for Room Morgue, or you just do editorial?
I've written stuff for those magazines, but I haven't done any kind of editorial stuff. I've written quite a few reviews for Cemetery Dance. I've written some articles for Famous Monsters and Room Morgue and Scream. But it's not, the freelancing, like, nonfiction stuff isn't something that I do a lot of. It's just something that I was doing that for a little while when I was trying to find out exactly what I wanted to do. I thought I wanted to do, you know, a lot of fiction and some nonfiction, and then it takes a whole different, it's a whole different creative process. And so I prefer doing the fiction for sure. But if I'm, you know, if I'm being compensated, then I'll do the nonfiction.
Yeah, and those are all great magazines. I love, well, I don't know Scream, but Room Morgue, Famous Monsters, and Cemetery Dance are all some of the best ones.
Yeah.
You know, working with them must be fun.
Scream is like the Fangoria of the UK. It's very popular over there.
Well, and we got Fangoria back now, which is so awesome.
Yeah, I actually tried to get in there too, but I think they got their, I think they do, I think that they do less freelance and more of like a staff type thing now.
Yeah, I mean, they had to figure out a way to make it work, so they're doing like bi-monthly episodes. But I'm glad to see they figured out a model that would work so they could come back, because they were, you know, such a staple of, you know, horror for me growing up in the 80s.
Oh, sure. I couldn't wait for the new issue to come out growing up in the 80s. And before that, I was reading Famous Monsters. And, of course, I preferred Fangoria because it took it to a whole nother level.
Yeah, I love Famous Monsters because I'm a huge fan of Forry Ackerman. I was going to do a documentary about him at one point, and we corresponded when I was in film school. And
really?
He was, you know, like, sure, come on out to the Acker Mansion. And he always used to call me Liebling Hansi. He was really sweet. And then by the time I got out to California, it was really too late. He just wasn't, he wasn't in good health, and...
that's too bad, because
I know
he's the type of guy that he would be all about, you know, having you come in you know, check out all the, he seems like he would be totally up for it.
What a collection he had. I mean, just amazing.
Yeah.
I think they broke up the collection when he passed away. I don't think anyone, you know, took it. I mean, it really should have been preserved.
Yeah, I think even before he died, he had to get rid of a lot of stuff.
Oh, man. I mean, he had like the original little model for King Kong, and, you know, he had Maria from Metropolis, and like a first edition of Dracula signed by Bela Lugosi and Christopher Lee. I mean, so many cool things. But some friends, you know, ended up doing a documentary on him. I don't know what happened to it. But apparently, for his birthday every year, he liked to get a cosplay girl. They'd hire someone to cosplay as, you know, whatever. And
like vampire or something?
Probably, yeah, exactly. But, the legacy of horror is amazing. I saw that, like, you've been compared to Jack Ketchum, which is just fucking amazing, right? One of my favorite writers.
Me too.
Quite a comparison, right?
He's I think a lot of that has to do with both Ketchum and I don't write a whole lot of, or he didn't write a whole lot of supernatural stuff, you know, or monsters and things like that. It was more like real life, you know, horrific things, and that's what I prefer to write and to read. And so, I mean, I have my fair share of short stories with, you know, supernatural stuff and things like that. But for the most part, my books are pretty free from that kind of stuff and deal with unique scenarios with, you know, things that could really potentially happen.
So tell me about some of your books. What's your favorite of all your works?
Man, you know, that's a tough question.
Or is it just the new one? Because I get that.
No, it's not really like that.
Okay.
No, it's not really like that. I mean, I like them all for different reasons, because so much of me is in each one, you know, whether it be real things, you know, stuff that really happened to me, or actual characters, people I knew, or, you know, based on things like that. But I think as far as like writing, the most fun that I had writing was probably either Skullface Boy or The Same Deep Water as You. The Same Deep Water as You is not, well, neither one of those books are, could really be considered horror. They're both pretty dark. But Skullface Boy was a lot of fun just because I got to do a lot of, there's a lot of weird stuff in there, and I drew a lot of influence from David Lynch, and particularly stuff like Wild at Heart, so some of the characters.
One of my favorites. I love that movie.
Yeah, me too. And just some of the characters that he creates are just so memorable and quirky, and there's a lot of that in Skullface Boy. And so that was fun. That was fun, a lot of fun to do. But I think it's not necessarily my favorite, but I have like a gateway book that I point people towards, and that's Foster Homes and Flies. And just because it kind of summarizes pretty well about like, you know, where my writing style and the type of stuff that I write, you know, it's horror, but it's not, but it's still dark, but yet it's hopeful. It kind of has all those elements that incorporated in there. So, but again, not my favorite, just something that is, I think is the best example of what you're going to get when you read something of mine. But I don't know that I can really pick a favorite.
Well, I understand. It's, you know, it's what was fun to write, because I know sometimes, you know, the work itself, even though it comes out well, your experience making it can be really painful and difficult. So it's hard to, you know, I mean, you can appreciate those works, but you're like, oh, I don't want to go back there.
Yeah. Like, even though The Same Deep Water as You was one of my favorites to write, it's never a book that I would say, oh, you haven't read anything of mine? Here, read this. Just because it's more, I wrote it more for me than anything. And hoping that, you know, if people like it, then cool. If they don't, that's fine. But, I understand that because of the topics in it and the fact that it's, you know, not horror but it still deals with some really dark stuff and some tragic things happen, and there's some disturbing stuff in it. It's not something that, you know, I think is an overall good representation. It was just kind of like almost an experiment that I was hoping that people would get on board with, and people have. So I kind of lucked out.
Yeah, well, it's nice to be able to experiment. I mean, why else are you making art if you're not trying new things? I mean, you're not just churning stuff out. That's not.
Yeah. No, I could never.
There's no quality in that. Yeah.
Yeah, I could never. I've got like too much, I guess, artistic integrity. I could never write to market. You know. Oh, vampires are popular. I'll write a vampire book. You know, zombies. I just don't. I don't have that in me to make that much investment into something just because it's you know, it would just feel like work. It wouldn't feel like art or anything. It wouldn't feel like me.
Yeah, I've had people suggest I do documentaries on certain things, and it's like, nah, it's too much work to work on something I'm not in love with and obsessed with.
That's what
drives me, so I can't just, you know, selling is not not the reason I make these things. I would never be a documentarian if it was about the money.
And if we had all these, if every author just, you know, did stuff that that was selling, then we wouldn't have, we certainly wouldn't have Jill Lansdale.
And, oh my God,
you know, with all of the, you know, and he clearly writes for himself because he's genres hops, you know, all over the place. So, yeah. And same with Ketchum, you know.
When we talked about The Drive-In, which is one of my favorite Lansdale books, he said it was like the least fun to write, you know.
Really?
You know, he'd written an article and the publisher said, you know, hey, there's a novel in this. And he's like, well, I need to write a novel. Okay. And he said it took him a couple months. It was the least fun. And then, you know, he thought it was terrible. And then when he got the page proofs back, he was like, oh, hey, this is actually pretty good.
Yeah, it is good.
It's fabulous.
Yeah, it's a lot of people's favorite.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a wild one. I would love
more like, I think Paradise Sky and those books, are his more literary books, are more his favorites.
I think Paradise Sky is his favorite, but I think that might be, it might be my favorite too.
Paradise Sky or Drive-In?
Paradise Sky.
Yeah. There's so many.
Yeah.
I mean, I haven't even read them all. And then, you know, when I was down visiting him to shoot, he just hands me another six and I'm like, crap, I already have like three on my nightstand I haven't read.
Yeah.
I can't read them as fast as he writes them. It's,
I would love to see him do like a you know, go back to like the splatterpunk type of thing, just to, you know, because I know he has fun doing the crime stuff. He does it really well, you know, the Happen Leonard and the westerns that he does, but to see him go back and kind of, you know, go over that territory, not like a Drive-In part three or anything, but like a, you know, just something in that vein that's just kind of outrageous that he did a long time ago.
There was a panel at KillerCon on splatterpunk, and that's how I got introduced to, you know, all these guys, you know, through that movement, you know. And John Skip was there, and I, you know, he was one of the first of them I read, right? Him, Skip Inspector. And so I'd been trying to get him to do an interview for the Joe Bob Briggs and then the Lansdale documentary, and he never had time, so I finally grabbed him at the con. And I was like, I really want to do an interview. He's like, oh, sure, you know. So we went to his hotel room and, you know, talked splatterpunk and New York and adventures and life stuff. And but the panel was really interesting because the splatterpunk writers were talking about, like, you know, how, you know, horror got such a boost in the 80s and then sort of like died in the 90s because suddenly every publisher just wanted their Stephen King or their Dean Koontz or their John Saul, for God's sakes.
Yeah, right. Yeah, that would have been upsetting, I suppose, and scary for the people who were doing, you know, all of the mass market paperbacks, and to see that kind of die out. It's like being in a hair metal band in the late 80s, and then all of a sudden Nirvana comes along and ruins everything for you.
Yeah, it's so funny. Well, I mean, and David Scow, I asked him about splatterpunk, right, and he coined the term. And he said, like, it was a joke, because once you name something, it no longer is a thing. And because then all these people are trying to be splatterpunk. And splatterpunk was such a diverse, you know, the writers in it were all completely different.
Yeah.
I mean, except maybe Skip Inspector were the only ones who were really sort of splatterpunky. Everybody else was kind of, like, doing their own voice.
Yeah, and I think that, yeah, people try to take some elements from a book and say, well, that's what this is. And, you know, it's like I understand categorizing stuff, and it can be useful just for, you know, trying to describe something, but at the same time, it can be frustrating for if you don't completely, you know, fit in that in that hole, in that box, then it can be kind of frustrating for someone to try to categorize what you're doing. And, you know, same way with bands.
Yeah. And I think, you know, and then the artists feel limited by, you know, trying to stay in that vein when, I mean, Lansdale obviously didn't. Lansdale doesn't give a fuck.
Yeah.
I think it's one of my favorite things about him that he's just kind of like, write as if everyone you know is dead. Just write for yourself.
Yeah.
You know, he's a stubborn motherfucker. He just won't. He just does what he wants to do, which is cool. But, you know, he said he never wanted to be, you know, rich or famous, although rich isn't bad.
Yeah, sure.
I think, you know, there's a bunch of writers who, you know, have maintained their artistic integrity and, you know, mm-hmm. have done okay. I wonder about Stephen King because I wonder if he feels like he's maintained his artistic integrity.
I don't know.
Yeah. What happens
when you
get that big?
I would assume that he feels pretty comfortable, I would think. You know, I don't feel like... I haven't read any of his... I think the newest book I read of his was Bazaar of Bad Dreams, but that really doesn't count. It's a short story collection, but I haven't read anything new by him for several years, so I really don't know. I mean, I've heard, you know, some people just really hated... What was it called? Elevation, I think it was called. But then...
I'm not sure, but I think the last ones I read were Dr. Sleep and 11-22-63. 11-22-63 was fantastic.
Yeah, Dr. that's
Sleep,
what I heard.
Not so much, but...
Yeah. I heard that was good. I heard The Outsider was really good, as well as Revival. I don't know. Some people.
Yeah, I've read them all, but you know what? They don't stick with me, a lot of them.
Yeah.
I mean, 11-22-63 really did because it was a really interesting structure. But the other ones sort of just, you know, you read them and then they're gone.
Yeah.
But God bless him, he's writing. I mean, he just keeps writing, so.
Yeah, he's as prolific as they come.
Yeah, he's a workhorse, you know. And Mick Garris was, you know, comparing, you know, him and Joe and saying, you know, and Joe's in Nagadocious and Stephen King's in Bangor, and they sort of keep their integrity by staying, you know, out of, like, New York or Hollywood or...
Yeah.
But that's probably true for a lot of you guys. I mean, you stay where you are to keep your voice...
If I could, I would not live where I live. I would probably...
Are you in probably, Michigan?
Yeah. I mean, it's not horrible. We don't have to deal with any kind of, you know, the winters aren't bad. I don't live in, like, you know, I live in Southwest Michigan. So the winters aren't bad. We don't have any hurricanes or you know, tsunamis or earthquakes. Well, we've had a couple of earthquakes, but they were, you know, very, very minor, you know, just things that we joke about around here. We don't have tornadoes. You know, we've had like two tornadoes, I think, in the last like 40 years. You know, we just don't have any like natural disasters or anything to be, you know, extreme, like humidity and stuff like that. I mean, it can get, you know, humid here, very hot, but, you know, we're not suffering like, you know, they are in Louisiana or something like that. And so all of that is nice. It's just that, it could stand to be more cultured, I think.
Well, I live in, you know, New York, so culture's not a problem, but it has, and now we're getting hurricanes the last couple of years, so, you know, they've gentrified the hell out of the city, so many neighborhoods that used to be, you know, artsy and interesting and affordable, you know, are no longer, you know, I've been...
Yeah.
You know, from various areas in New York, I've been pushed out of apartments and lost And now I'm back in like the neighborhood I grew up in my husband's family's, you know, rent controlled apartment, because it's, you know, otherwise we couldn't stay in New York. And but I'd move to Canada in a minute right now.
I'm not a fan of cold. Free healthcare sounds nice, but I don't like cold weather.
Yeah, well, it does get really cold.
It's not the cold that bothers me as much as snow. I just don't like snow.
Yeah, I'll forget Canada then. Although I don't know how bad the snow is in Vancouver. I mean, I go to Toronto all the time, but I'm not sure about, you know, the west coast of Canada if it's better. I think Vancouver is probably okay.
I've only been to Canada, I think, once and stayed there for a week or so, but it was in the summertime, so I have no idea about their weather.
Do you think your work is sort of based in, you know, sort of a Michigan voice? Do you feel like it has that aspect to it?
I don't personally think so, but not really. I don't think so. I think because I draw a lot of influence from, I probably draw more influence from indie films than I do even from books. And I'm a huge fan of indie films, especially like dialogue-driven, character-driven films, things like Bottle Rocket, Prince Avalanche. There's so many that I like that are just, you know, a cast of minimal characters, but the acting is great, but the you know, situations are real, the characters just feel real, and they just feel, you know, kind of artsy, but not artistic to the point where it's alienating, you know, they're not too artsy, which doesn't bother me at all. But I don't think that enough people watch indie films, and I don't know why, because they're so much better than 80% of the stuff that's in theaters.
They're harder to access. You know, I mean, they only play in limited release, you know, so it's not like you can go to your local, you know, multiplex and see. You know, you have to go in New York, you'd have to go like the Film Forum or, you know, IFC Theater or, you know, Sunshine, or, you know, you have to make more of an effort to see them. And then in terms of, you know, promotion, they get a lot less, you know, than the latest Marvel or.
Yeah. If you're wanting to see a movie in the theater, then yeah, you have to make more of an effort. But I mean, you could just, you know, hop on Amazon Prime or Netflix or whatever, and it's got a lot of that stuff.
Yeah, but you know, you kind of have to know what you're looking for too for that. You know?
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
There's not as much promotion for those films, but you know, if you know a director you like, you can, you know, just, and then you can track them down. I was feeling really shitty at New York, and so there's a bunch of films I love that were like filmed in New York in the 70s and 80s. So that, you know, you can see the city at the time when it was the greatest for me. Mm-hmm. And so I just watched the original Shaft.
Yeah.
Which is such a great film. And I had forgotten, I didn't know that Gordon Parks was like a photographer and for life for many years before he started making films. So watching the film, knowing that, suddenly I could see, like, you know, this sort of documentarian view of New York. They shot in Times Square, they shot in Harlem, they shot in the West Village, and there's, you know, you see, like, you know, Bonds in Times Square, or, like, Café Reggio in the Village, Café Wa, like, that he made sure to capture, you know, the city as a character as well.
Yeah, it's got a great soundtrack, though.
Yeah, Isaac Hayes and the Movement, man, you know. And I thought it was a low-budget film, but I Googled because I'm like, this looks great. It was like $500,000, which in 1971 is a pretty good chunk of change. But but they made $12 million in box office.
Wow. I know they remade it recently, and it looked horrible.
Yeah, and I really like John Singleton, you know, who directed the new one. I haven't even watched it, though, but I think, like, Shaft was of a time, you know, the character and everything was of a time in New York, and I don't think you can, you know, remake it with, you know, without losing a lot of that.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah, that was part
like
of its appeal.
Yeah, I mean, you know, this, you know, private eye who, you know, is respected by the white cops, but, you know, also, you know, respected by the Black Panthers, and, you know, it was a really interesting portrayal of this character that I don't think we'd seen before, except maybe, like, Chester Himes' P.I. novels. But I don't think we'd seen it on screen before. So, and it holds up really well.
I haven't seen it in probably decades.
Yeah, it's definitely worth a rewatch. I was surprised how well it held up, because some of those, you know, now I have to watch Ganja and Hess. You know, going back and forth between, well, I love old movies. There's so many good old movies, so many good classics. So even like, even Basket Case and stuff, like you see old New York and you're like, you know, he's walking down Times Square, he's standing at SRO. Yeah, I'm just stuck in the 80s, you know, it's such a good time in New York.
Oh, it was. Yeah, lots of carefree days. For sure.
Yeah, the music, the film, the art of that period just really speaks to me. And I don't know if it's because I lived it or it's just an aesthetic that, you know, draws me.
I think probably a little bit of both. I wonder about that sometimes too, because I think that, you know, I think about a lot of it is nostalgia, and it feels good. You know, we've got these attachments to, you know, maybe better days where we don't have to work and we just get to, you know, be young and free and not have all these responsibilities and just the, you know, all the music was the soundtrack for that, and all the movies were just, you know, and anything that reflects that, it just feels good. And so I think part of it, a big part of it is just like nostalgia. I think that if we maybe grew up in a different era, it would be the same way. It reminds me of when I was like in the 80s, when I would look back and I would see like my grandpa or whatever, and he would be wearing, you know, his 50 styles clothes and his 50 styles hair, and he was just like stuck in the era. And I think that just happens with every generation. They feel comfortable, you know,
with the period when they were young and free. And
yeah, it just makes them. Yeah, it makes you feel comfortable, and then so they'll watch their westerns all day because that's what they grew up on, and listen to the, you know, the same music and stuff like that. It's just it feels comfortable and familiar. Brings back you know, maybe better days. Getting old is no fun, and so if you can have something to take you back, you know, like you know, even the colors of the 80s. You know, I feel like that identifying colors with decades is over. It feels like, you know, the 50s, 60s, and 70s, and 80s can all, I feel like they can all be represented by certain colors. And I don't feel like that, with the exception of maybe plaid in the 90s, I don't feel like that with the last, you know, 30 years.
Yeah, plaid was cool. But, you know, I'm a big Replacements fan, so love plaid. And, you know, punk was also, there was a lot of plaid in punk.
Like UK stuff. They were more into like the fashion thing, you know.
The fashion thing actually started with Richard Hell. He's the first one that dressed like that. And then the UK adopted it. So, you know, and then the Ramones.
Like, if you take a band like you go see the Sex Pistols, you know, in, you know, 77, 78, and they get their safety pins and all that kind of stuff, and the orange hair and the spiky hair. And then around that same time, 77, 78, like, you go see Black Flag, and it's just jeans and t-shirts, you know. So I think it's, you know, and same with, you know, the Ramones and Iggy Pop. It was just more of a, well, Iggy was in and out of some different, you know, yeah, I think he had a pair or two of like platinum pants and things like that. But for the most part, it was just, you know,
no shirt. Always had to be no shirt.
Yeah. It's still.
I know.
Which, but I think is awesome. Because,
yeah,
because no man that age has any business not wearing a shirt, but he just doesn't care. And I think that is so cool because he clearly should have a shirt on. You know, he looks like he's he looks like a raisin that's been ran over and left out in the sun. But I think I have a lot of respect for him for doing that because he's the only one that would, you know, you'd never see Mick Jagger up there bouncing around still with no shirt on.
No.
He couldn't pull it off.
Keith did dye his hair for this last tour, which I was like, what the fuck? Because Keith has not cared what he looked like, you know, for decades. I'm like, what the?
Yeah.
Why now are you dyeing your hair? I mean, it was white for years. I don't. And maybe after Mick's, you know, heart attack, he felt like we need to feel younger.
Maybe.
I hope they tour again. I actually had a ticket to see them, and we were, you know, hustling to get the film done. So by the time the day came when, you know, I had the ticket and I was going to drive to Jersey, it's like I had like a massive anxiety attack because I had just stuffed all my feelings for weeks while we worked on the cut. And then, like, as soon as I had a break, I was like, no, I can't do this. I can't drive. I can't be around people. It was really sad. And I, like, couldn't sell the ticket because I had a hard ticket. And it was just like I had to, like, just eat $300. And I really wanted to see them, but I just, you know, sometimes mental health stuff.
Yeah. I would love to see the Stones. I've never seen them.
I know. Me either. I never, because I kept, for years, I kept saying, well, I'll wait until they play a small venue. And I realize now they will never play a small venue.
Yeah. I don't think they've been able to do that for many, many years.
I think they did one at the Fonda in LA a couple of years ago, but I'm sure it was like a private event. And,
you know, yeah, friends probably had more. They were probably, when they put that blues album out, they had a straight up blues record that they put out.
Yeah, I hope I get a chance to see them. I've kind of been trying to see everyone I can because I work, one of my day jobs is box office at Forest Hill Stadium. And Petty was playing there, and we can always go into the shows after the box office closed. So, and that day I was like out of town at a convention. I was like, you know, it's okay. I'll catch him next time. And of course, there was no next time. So I'm trying now to see everybody I didn't get a chance to see because, you know, at least I got to see Willie and Johnny Cash. So, you know, to those guys, you know, I'm glad I caught Cash before he passed away. I got him in the 90s, Carnegie Hall. And then Willie, nice. I just saw like last year, and he was amazing. But yeah, got to see them while they're still alive because they won't be around forever.
Right. That's true.
Yeah. Yeah. So, is there anything you're promoting or you want to let people know about in terms of your work? Or?
Yeah. Yeah, sure. September 20th, there's the hardcover release of Fostrums and Flies, and that's being put out by Poltergeist Press. And then on the 27th, I have a brand new book called The Pale White being published by Lake Publishing.
I've seen the promotions for that. That looks really interesting.
Yeah, the cover hasn't been done yet, but hopefully the artist will be done with it soon, and we'll be able to, because it's a month from today, it will be out, and I'm really excited about it, excited for people to read it. It is a female-centric coming-of-age story, which there aren't very many of, so I'm hoping that I won't disappoint all the ladies who are looking for something like that and can dig into that and enjoy it. It's another dark and sad but hopeful story about trauma.
Oh, and with a female protagonist. Very cool.
Yep. Three of them.
And people can find you. You also have a Patreon.
Yeah, I have a Patreon page.
Support your work.
Yep, I have exclusive short stories on there and videos and all kinds of stuff. And I try to put as much exclusive content up there as I can for Patreons. You can pledge anywhere from $2 to $20. I think I got to set it like $2 and $5 and then $20, but sometimes people put $7 in there. I didn't know you could change your thing like that, but I guess you can. But the links to all that can be found at my website, which is www.chadlutsky.com.
Okay, I'll put it in the show notes. I'll put the link in the show notes for it.
Okay. Yeah, my last name isn't exactly like, you know, you might have to look at it before you type it in.
I understand. I have a difficult name too.
Yes, you do.
Yeah, people are always like, how do you pronounce your first name? Which, you know, I appreciate, but you know, most of them get it fairly close.
Yeah.
And Oppenheimer is not easy either, but it's a little bit more, you know, known than Hansi anyway. But yeah, I'll put your Patreon and your website link in the show notes. Is there anything else you want me to add?
I don't think so. Just thanks for hanging out, talking music and stuff like that, and about Joe Lansdale, of course.
Yeah, and, I'm obsessed right now. Just living in Joe's world for the last, you know, whatever, 9 months. It's hard to get out of my head. It's so funny now, too, because once you've heard his voice, like, everything of his you read now, you read in his voice, you can hear it.
You know, I thought that was just me until I just, I think maybe it was something that you posted recently on Twitter or Facebook, but when I read that, I was like, oh my gosh, that's not just me, because I can't help but do that. Because I listened to him do a reading, and then every time that I you know, read his stuff, that's the voice in my head. And then I listened to a couple of his Happy Leonard books on audio. And that guy, I don't know who was doing it, but that guy was kind of, you know, emulating Joe as well. So, yeah, it was weird to see you post that, because I thought it was just me.
No, and it's funny because the first time I went to meet him, I wanted to sort of catch up on some of my favorite books of his. So I was looking at a copy, my old copy from the 80s of The Magic Wagon. Couldn't find it. Still in boxes. So I ended up downloading the audiobook. And Chet Williamson does the audiobook. And he definitely takes a East Texas accent. You can definitely, like, hear it's, you know, similar to Joe. It's not Joe, but it's similar. He's definitely using that cadence and stuff. And,
right.
Yeah, Joe should just do all his own audiobooks. That'd be awesome.
Thanks for joining us this week on the Gurr and Fangirl. If you enjoyed our show, be sure to visit our website, www.squeeprojects.com, where you can subscribe to the podcast and our YouTube channel for lots more squee-as-fuck pop culture content.